It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Protests spread through the U.S. in the aftermath of a ruling in a controversial shooting incident. And female suicide bombers strike a market in northeastern Nigeria. I'm Michael Lippin. Protests have erupted in major cities around the United States in response to a controversial ruling in a shooting incident in the Midwestern town of Ferguson. Hundreds of people marched peacefully in the streets of New York City, Washington, Baltimore, Atlanta, Chicago, and Los Angeles, some of them blocking traffic. The protesters expressed anger about a grand jury's decision not to indict a white policeman who fatally shot an unarmed black teenager in Ferguson in August. A day earlier, riots erupted in Ferguson soon after a local prosecutor announced the grand jury's decision. U.S. President Barack Obama criticized those who looted and set fire to local buildings, calling them criminals who should be prosecuted. Many residents of the predominantly black town viewed the shooting as a case of racially motivated brutality by their mostly white police force. But the grand jury said there was not enough evidence to prosecute the officer, who said he was acting in self-defense against a heavily built youth who grabbed his gun and charged at him. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon deployed more than 2,000 National Guard troops to Ferguson on Tuesday to try to prevent more violence. Reports from Nigeria say two female suicide bombers have attacked a market in the northeastern city of Maiduguri, killing dozens of people. Witnesses say Tuesday's attack began with the first bomber setting off her explosives and killing several people. As people gathered at the blast site, they say the second attacker blew herself up. A reporter for VOA in Maiduguri put the death toll at 37. You're listening to VOA News. South Sudan's two warring factions are coming under increasing pressure from the UN Security Council to resolve their deadly year-long conflict. As VOA's Margaret Bashir reports, the council is moving closer to imposing targeted sanctions on the two parties.
Australia's UN ambassador, Gary Quinlan, who's president of the 15-nation council this month, told reporters the council is very concerned about the political crisis that has killed thousands, left nearly 2 million people displaced, and 100,000 sheltering in makeshift UN protection camps. Ambassador Quinlan laid the blame for the misery squarely at the feet of President Salva Kiir and his political rival and former vice president, Riek Machar.
The fact is, this is a man-made disaster and a violent power struggle between the two chief architects in South Sudan's political elite. It can be stopped if they were to move back from the current pursuit of their own selfish, narrow political interests, and that's a united view in the council.
He said the council decided some time ago that it is prepared to move forward with targeted sanctions if necessary, possibly including an arms embargo, and that some members have discussed possible measures among themselves. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Syrian rights activists say government warplanes have killed at least 60 people in airstrikes on the region of Raqqa, where Islamic State militants have established a self-proclaimed capital. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said Tuesday's strikes hit an industrial zone and a popular market. The observatory says at least 36 of those killed were civilians, with more than a dozen others wounded. The Syrian government has launched frequent attacks on Islamic State targets in Raqqa. The world's biggest oil exporter, Saudi Arabia, and other key energy producers have failed to reach agreement on cutting production as a way of stopping a sharp drop in oil prices. Saudi oil minister Ali Al-Naimi met with energy officials from Venezuela, Russia, and Mexico in Vienna on Tuesday. The four countries agreed only to monitor world oil prices and to meet again in 3 months. Saudi Arabia and Venezuela are members of the 12-nation OPEC cartel, which supplies about a third of the world's oil. Russia and Mexico are not OPEC members, but are major oil producers. And here in the U.S., the busiest travel day of the year could be a rough one for millions of Americans on Wednesday. A major winter storm called a nor'easter is forecast to hit the U.S. eastern seaboard from Maine to North Carolina on the same day that Americans hit the roads, rails, and skies for Thursday's Thanksgiving holiday. Large cities including Boston, New York, and Philadelphia will feel the impact. I'm Michael Lippin.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN Security Council moves closer to sanctions on both sides in South Sudan's conflict.
The fact is, this is a man-made disaster and a violent power struggle between the two chief architects in South Sudan's political elite. It can be stopped if they were to move back from the current pursuit of their own selfish, narrow political interests.
Gary Quinlan is Australia's ambassador to the United Nations. The suspended leader of Zambia's opposition MMD party wins a court injunction. Sexual abuse survivors in Mali seek justice. A new report says Zimbabwe has a poor investment climate and remains politically unstable. And Boko Haram continues its campaign of violence across Nigeria.
He says for them, religion is just a cover.
If you say you are a Muslim and you want to create a caliphate and you are killing same Muslims, then who are you creating the caliphate for?
Bawa Abdullahi Watts is a security analyst at the Nigeria-based Network for Justice. And President Barack Obama described Ferguson, Missouri violent protesters as criminals who should be prosecuted. Those stories plus Mark Omar, Sports and Our Listener of the Day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The UN Security Council's patience with the two sides in South Sudan's deadly year-long conflict appeared to be running out on Tuesday. As VOA's Margaret Bashir reports from the United Nations, the council is closer to imposing targeted sanctions on the parties.
Australia's UN ambassador, Gary Quinlan, who's president of the 15-nation council this month, told reporters the council is very concerned about the political crisis that has killed thousands, left nearly 2 million people displaced, and 100,000 sheltering in makeshift UN protection camps. Ambassador Quinlan laid the blame for the misery squarely at the feet of President Salva Kiir and his political rival and former vice president, Riek Machar.
The fact is, this is a man-made disaster and a violent power struggle between the two chief architects in South Sudan's political elite. It can be stopped if they were to move back from the current pursuit of their own selfish, narrow political interests, and that's a united view in the council.
He said the council decided some time ago that it is prepared to move forward with targeted sanctions if necessary, possibly including an arms embargo, and that some members have discussed possible measures among themselves. Peace talks between Mr. Kiir and Machar in Addis Ababa under the auspices of regional group IGAD have so far not delivered any deal. Ambassador Quinlan said the council has been taking its lead from IGAD and had given its mediators space to work toward a November 24th deadline for reaching an agreement. With no accord in sight, the council now will have to consider other options. Earlier Tuesday, during a vote to renew for another 6 months the 12,500-member UN peacekeeping force in South Sudan, that country's envoy, Francis Madang Dang, warned the council that a sustainable solution to the conflict cannot be achieved through sanctions. He said they only tend to harden positions toward confrontation rather than cooperation. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The suspended president of Zambia's opposition movement for multi-party democracy, MMD party, has won a court injunction. Nevers Mumba had asked the court to declare his suspension illegal, null and void. But MMD National Secretary Muhabi Longu says the party is not threatened by Mr. Nevers' court injunction. Longu reportedly said Nevers should forget about being chosen the party's presidential candidate in next January's special presidential election because the party has already chosen its candidate. But Raphael Nakasinda, communications director in the office of party president Mumba, says the MMD constitution automatically recognizes the party president as its presidential candidate.
He got an injunction, an order to stop the national secretary of the party from interfering with his functions as party president.
But Mr. Mumba has already been suspended or removed.
There has been an illegal process that the national secretary, in collaboration with the former president, engaged in to try and create a vacancy in the president as a way of wanting to bring Mutia Banda back into the party.
The MMD national secretary is Muhabi Longu, is that correct?
Yes, Muhabi Longu.
Mr. Lungu has said that the party does not feel threatened by the injunction that Mr. Mumba got. He says, what does he want to stop? Because if it is the suspension, he has already been suspended. If he wants to stop the choosing of a presidential candidate, we have already chosen the candidate. So he is saying, in reality, the injunction that Mr. Mumba got is nothing.
Unless Mr. Lungu and Mr. Banda do not believe in the rule of law, which I would say at this particular stage, they are bad signs which the Zambian people and the world must watch out for. Because if we cannot respect our courts and the orders that come from court, then they are already showing signs of a people that will not respect the rule of law. And therefore, if they are given a chance to get into government, we will end up with a dictatorial kind of leadership.
Does Mr. Mumba still believe that he can be the presidential candidate of the MMD?
It's not just about believing. That is the provision of our constitution. There is nowhere in our constitution where it says that when an election comes, then you should begin to look for another candidate when there is a sitting president who is eligible to stand. So what Lungu is trying to do, who is a tribesman of Mr. Banda, is to try and find illegal means and rally around people that come from the region where Mr. Banda is coming from to try and remove Nevos Mumba and go about justifying that action. There is no way they can clean up this thing. It is wrong, it is illegal, and it should not be tolerated, even if it looks as though RRB has a higher chance to win. The mere fact that it is emanating from an illegal process, it shouldn't be tolerated. We should not just be doing things for political expedience. We should make sure that the foundation upon which every action is taken is legally correct, morally correct, and politically correct.
Rafael Nakasinda is the communications director for Zambia's opposition MMD party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. Zimbabwe has a poor investment climate and remains politically unstable for serious investors to pour their money into the country, says the British expertise and organization from the United Kingdom in a new report following a visit to Zimbabwe by a British trade delegation. The report cites ongoing political squabbles in the ruling ZANU-PF, adding divisions in the opposition movement for democratic change formations are also not inspiring potential investors. Erwin Chifera reports from Harare.
The report titled Zimbabwe Scoping Report 28 to 31 October 2014 says political stability in Zimbabwe, which is key for the country's economic recovery, will largely depend on the possibility of a leadership change in ZANU-PF should President Robert Mugabe decide to leave office before the 28 presidential elections. The report predicts Mr. Mugabe's departure could spark a power struggle between possible successors. Currently, Justice Minister Emmerson Mnangagwa seems to be winning the battle to replace Mr. Mugabe, with Vice President Joyce Mujuru being dislodged in a move that has seen most of her supporters being removed from their party positions. According to the report, there will be protracted inter-party squabbling in both ZANU-PF and the MDC before the next elections. Zimbabwe Democracy Institute Director Pesa Ruanya tells Studio 7 there cannot be any economic recovery without political stability.
There will not be any economic regeneration without the regeneration of our politics. Our politics needs renewal, our politics needs reform, the leadership needs renewal, the leadership needs to be reformed.
The report also says the Zimbabwean government must clarify its indigenization law, which the delegation says is a barrier to potential investors. Britain is a member of the European Union, whose ambassador to Zimbabwe, Philippe Van Dam, last week said though the union is engaging the Zimbabwean government, some reforms are urgently needed to align the country's laws to the constitution, as well as clarifying the empowerment law.
One of the reforms announced in that program is, for example, clarification of the Indigenization and Economic Empowerment Act. We are not discussing the choice of the government in terms of indigenization. What the investors ask is clarification of the loopholes, ambiguities, and so that we create a level playing field which is predictable for everyone.
Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa recently told a conference meeting in South Africa that Zimbabwe is ready to revise the controversial empowerment law to protect foreign investment in the country. But according to the report, Youth, Indigenization and Economic Empowerment Minister Francis Nema told the British business delegation that the empowerment law would remain the same and was not likely to be changed or amended in the foreseeable future. The World Bank currently ranks Zimbabwe number 170 out of 189 for ease of doing business. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
It is Wednesday morning, November 26th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 minutes past the hour. A twin bombing in Nigeria's northeastern city of Maiduguri on Tuesday showed the continuing ability of the militant group Boko Haram to attack at will. But even after a five-year insurgency, much else about the group, including its strength, the territory it controls, and its relation to the Islamic State group, remains unclear. Chris Stein reports from Abuja.
To stop Boko Haram, Nigeria's government has declared a state of emergency, deployed the military, and even tried to negotiate with the group. But Boko Haram's ability to overrun towns and carry out destructive bombing seems unchecked, while many aspects of the group's operations and motives remain a mystery. On Wednesday, twin suicide bombings killed more than 30 people in Maiduguri, the capital of Borno State, one of three states placed under emergency rule by the government last year. What little is known about Boko Haram often comes from the group itself, in the form of videos released to the media. The latest one, released this month, shows villagers cheering fighters in a town that's apparently been taken over by the militants. It ends with a reference to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State group, which has seized territory in Iraq and Syria and declared a caliphate. Boko Haram's leader, Abubakar Shekau, has expressed a similar desire for a caliphate, but Bawa Abdullahi Wasi, a security analyst and executive associate at the Nigeria-based Network for Justice, says that's just rhetoric. The number of people within Boko Haram fighting for religious reasons is few, he says. Rather, the group represents a motley coalition of criminals, violent political agitators, and people fighting for the sake of money. He says for them, religion is just a cover.
If you say you are a Muslim and you want to create a caliphate, and you are killing same Muslims, then who are you creating the caliphate for? Are you bringing people from the moon to come and settle there? So that is to tell you that the religious protections are only being mentioned there to achieve certain mechanization.
Ryan Cummings, chief Africa analyst at Red 24, a South Africa-based crisis management firm, says it's difficult to get a grasp of how much territory Boko Haram controls and what's happening in territories they rule. The group and Nigeria's military have traded control of some towns repeatedly, and few independent observers have been able to enter territory the group has captured.
Complications in terms of access of these areas to journalists and also, you know, the provision of information by an obviously biased Nigerian government has also skewed the exact circumstances that are prevailing within the northeast.
The group has recently carried out bombings in the northeastern states of Bauchi and Yobe, hitting civilian targets like schools and markets. Cummings says that could be a sign that it's looking to expand its fight.
It could be suggestions that Boko Haram are seeking to firstly highlight the operational presence within these areas and possibly seek to extend the insurgency outside of Adamawa, Yobe, and Borno to these areas. I think that is a trend that one cannot discount.
The group has also expanded northward, attacking the town of Damasak near the border with Niger on Monday, forcing people to head across the border for safety. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
Human rights organizations have filed a complaint on behalf of 80 survivors of rape and sexual violence during the occupation of northern Mali. More than 2,000 women and girls were subjected to rape or forced marriages from 2012 to 2013 when Islamist extremists and separatist rebels took control of Gao and Timbuktu. This is the first independent attempt to bring justice for the victims. Katerina Hoyer reports from Bamako.
When Gao and Timbuktu first came under occupation in January 2012, hundreds of women and young girls were raped, often by several offenders. That summer, when Islamist militants took power in the occupied towns, they imposed a system of forced marriage. While the rebels would attack women on their way to the field, going to fetch water, or even in their homes, the Islamists had a different approach, says lawyer and human rights defender Mokhtar Maiko. The Mujao forced women to marry them, which he says resulted in another system of rape, when only one man married the woman, who was then forced to sleep with several other men. Human rights groups and local NGOs have identified at least 2,700 survivors of rape and sexual violence between March 2012 and early 2013 in Gao, Kidal and Timbuktu. In Gao, the main offenders were the rebels in the National Movement for the Liberation of Azawad, MNLA, and later Mujao, the Movement for Oneness and Jihad in West Africa. In Timbuktu, Ansar Dine, another Islamist group, and Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb, Akim, committed a majority of the violations against women. To date, very little has been done to help the women. There are still no proper courts or a functioning legal system in the north, and investigations are slow, says Maiko. He says cases referred to the police were never investigated. Together with Malian Human Rights Association, AMDH, and French Human Rights Group, FIDH, Maiko represents 80 women who are survivors of the sexual violence. The oldest victim was over 60 years, the youngest only 7. While many women fled during that time, some stayed behind. But for those who have returned, many are forced to face their aggressors on a daily basis, as some of the perpetrators have been released in prison exchanges between the armed groups and the Malian government. Sometimes the offender is a neighbor or even a family member who joined the rebels. This poses a direct threat to the women, says Mariam Sek with NGO Sinisanuma. The organization has helped women with medical assistance, counseling, safe place to stay, and help starting legal complaints. But even if women are ready to take their case to court, they face another obstacle. The majority of defenders remain in the north, while the victims fled to the south. So early this year, a group of lawyers traveled north to Gao, Timbuktu, and Kona, where they worked with women's groups to identify victims. The women were later brought to Bamako, where the lawyers collected the testimonies. While many women do know their offenders, some could only identify them by the language they spoke. Another problem is that many victims can't read or write and aren't aware of their rights. Human rights defenders, by going to the victims, now hope more women will dare to file complaints as the first cases move to court. This is Katerina Hoye for VOA News in Bamako.
President Barack Obama has deployed Monday night's destructive actions by some protesters in Ferguson, Missouri, following the announcement that a grand jury did not indict white police officer Darren Wilson in the shooting death of 18-year-old black teenager Michael Brown. Speaking Tuesday in Chicago, Mr. Obama said those responsible should be prosecuted, but he also said he understands that many people are upset by the grand jury decision.
Burning buildings, torching cars, destroying property, putting people at risk, that's destructive, and there's no excuse for it. Those are criminal acts, and people should be prosecuted if they engage in criminal acts. But what we also saw, although it didn't get as much attention in the media, was people gathering in overwhelmingly peaceful protests here in Chicago and New York and Los Angeles, other cities. We've seen young people who are organizing and people beginning to have real conversations about how do we change the situation so that there's more trust between law enforcement and some of these communities. And those are necessary conversations to have. So my message to those people who are constructively moving forward, trying to organize, mobilize, and ask hard, important questions about how we improve the situation, I want all those folks to know that their president is going to work with them. And I think you'll find a lot of... separate and apart from the particular circumstances of Ferguson, which I am careful not to speak to because it's not my job as president to comment on ongoing investigations and specific cases, but the frustrations people have generally, those are rooted in some hard truths that have to be addressed. And so those who are prepared to work constructively, your president will work with you. So as part of that, I've instructed Attorney General Eric Holder not just to investigate what happened in Ferguson, but also identify specific steps we can take together to set up a series of regional meetings focused on building trust in our communities.
And that was U.S. President Barack Obama speaking Tuesday night in Chicago. And it's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And let's join Mark Omar in Johannesburg, South Africa. And very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with hockey. In an all-Egyptian tie, defending champions Sakia and Egyptian police drew 1-1 in the men's contest at the Africa Club Hockey Championships in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe on Tuesday. Ghana's trustees thrashed Nigeria's police machine 4-0. In an all-Zimbabwean encounter, Hippo Valley outplayed Eradicators 5-2. Meanwhile, in the women's contest, Kenyan defending champions Orange Telkom overran Tanzania's 29-0. Zimbabwe's Bulawayo Athletics Club and Nigeria's Heartland drew 3-3, while Kenya's Strathmore University overwhelmed Malawi's Genetrix 12-0. Turning to athletics, hosts Japan came from behind on the final leg to eclipse defending champions Kenya and win the Chiba International Ekiden Relay in Chiba on Monday. Each team consisted of three men and three women running different distances, which added up to the length of a standard marathon. While Japan celebrated their first win at the annual event in 5 years, Russia is the surprise bronze medalist. In football, Algerian fans will undergo special treatment to prevent them from the potential of contracting Ebola virus while in Equatorial Guinea to cheer the Desert Fox during the Orange Africa Cup of Nations next January, the Algerian sports minister Mohamed Tahmi told the Algiers media. He says while Algerian federation officials will be in Malabo, Equatorial Guinea for the draws next week, a separate team of Algerian health officials will be in the country to assess what measures needed to be taken to prevent potential infection. Equatorial Guinea has no recorded case of Ebola infection. Nonetheless, Equatorial Guinea has engaged 50 Cuban doctors who are sharing their expertise with local medical authorities. These initiatives come in handy ahead of the expected influx of fans from across the continent for the Nations Cup in January. Finally, Ugandans who recently secured Olympic Solidarity Scholarships to train ahead of the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics could lose their scholarships should they decline in their performances during their respective Olympic qualifying campaigns, the Uganda Olympic Committee Secretary General Donald Rukare revealed in Kampala on Tuesday. The 18 athletes will compete in badminton, lawn tennis, rowing, swimming, and weightlifting. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And yes, our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, November 26.
Good morning, Daybreak Africa. I think Mr. Roberts certainly does not deserve the vote of the people of Montserrat County. My question is, where was Mr. Robert Sully 10 years ago, 25 years ago, when bullets were flying in Liberia, when refugees were suffering in the neighboring country? Where is our oil wealth? How will the people of Montserrat County entrust a man that his mother party, the Unity Party, have referred to him as a monster and an enemy to a party that brought his mother to power? Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment. And that's it for this Wednesday, November 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, host Shaka Sally sits down with Sarah Obama and Saeed Obama, U.S. President Barack Obama's grandmother and uncle from Kenya. She'll join him to talk about her new project, the Mama Sarah Obama Foundation. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Douglas Mpoga. Join me for VOA's discussion program, Reporters Roundtable, every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests that share their ideas and take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA.